brought to you by GloryGiftStore.com. At GloryGiftStore.com, we offer the very latest in quality Christian supplies, from DVDs and books to Bibles in every translation, communion, jewelry, T-shirts, clergy robes, and even homeschooling supplies are also available. GloryGiftStore.com, where you'll find everything to meet your Christian needs. So stop by GloryGiftStore.com today. That's GloryGiftStore.com.
Shout out to GloryGiftStore.com. And so thankful to have a sponsor. And if you get a chance, stop by there today. The website, GloryGiftStore.com. They have everything Christian. And if you type in the promotional code bar, you type in Choose to Joy, all one word, you'll get 15% off anything you purchase. Welcome to the Choose to Joy broadcast, or podcast. I have a special guest. He's been on once before. He's hosted the show. He's my brother, my ace boon coon, my man. I knew him before he was born. I knew him when he got born again. I knew him when he got born again. And I needed somebody to come on the show. He said, man, Eric, I got you. What do you want to talk about? And he actually had a great idea. It's something very personal to him, so I appreciate him opening up his life again. And hopefully this time it won't cause any problems, you know, with him and his spouse. But anyway, we won't talk about that without further ado. Mr. Trey Duffin, you there?
I'm here, brother. What's going on?
Man, Jesus, man. It's all about him, man. And, man, let me prep this up because we can hop right on in this. But I remember I was in Berlin, Ohio in 2012, and I get a message on Facebook from my sister, and it said, Eric, will you please call the house? We have a family emergency. Do you remember the day that I'm talking about?
I believe I do, Eric. Yeah, that would be August the 27th of 2012. I remember it vividly.
I do. Man.
I do, man.
What happened, man? What was going on through your mind?
Well, man, it all happened so fast, man. What happened for me was it was very early that morning. It was actually before dawn. It was still dark outside, and I just remember hearing beating at my front door. And, man, to be honest, it didn't really even alarm me or frighten me any. I just turned over and my wife hopped up before I even got up, and she went to the door, and, man, the next thing I knew, it was like a SWAT team was in my house, in my bedroom, had guns pointed at my head, man. It was like they came to get, man, Michael Corleone, Pablo Escobar. I don't know what. It was, them folks meant serious business.
Did they really have guns pointed at your head, though?
Oh yeah, it was serious. Yeah, they was full vest, dressed out, shotguns, handguns, the whole nine yards. It was a squad of folks, man. It was at least, you know, it was about a dozen folks, man. Maybe a little less, you know. Seemed like it waned out once, you know, they actually, I guess, in their terms, secured the situation. But yeah, originally there was a lot of people there. It felt like it, maybe not a dozen altogether, man. It wasn't like, I don't believe it was the real SWAT team, but it was a lot of undercover agents and police dressed in, you know, fatigues and bulletproof vests and all that type stuff, man. And so they came in pretty strong and hard and sudden early that morning.
And, did you know what was about to happen to you at this moment?
Man, it couldn't have been further from my mind, man. The idea that something that serious of that magnitude would happen to me, even knowing what I was doing, it was just laughable to me, man. It was very laughable. I would have never dreamed. And so it was very surreal and shocking. It almost couldn't be scary at first because it seemed so unreal. it wasn't like a fear come true, because I never really feared it happening, not in that sense, you know, at all. And so it was just very surreal at the beginning, to be honest, man, very surreal. And it increasingly became, you know, a little more and more just scary in nature, in terms of fear and thoughts and what's going to happen and all that type of stuff. And I believe it began to really set in for me as I was sitting there in handcuffs after, you know, a little while has gone by. They're not really saying much to me at this point. They just handcuff you and sit you on your own furniture somewhere, and they go about doing their business and searching stuff. And they done ran dogs all through my house, and of course, there was nothing there. And so, but it began to dawn on me, man, that this wasn't going to be over briefly when, man, they started hauling my furniture out while I was still sitting on it. Trucks pulling up outside, pulling my Lexus off. I seen the Expedition driving away. I said, man, I ain't even got booked or nothing yet, and they already taking stuff. So it had me thinking that it was more serious than I ever would have thought it could have been, given the situation. But I had a lot to learn, man, of what was really possible. And so, yeah, it was very sudden and scary day that day, very surreal day that day.
Man, I got so many questions to ask you about that, but just for the purposes that we don't try to make it seem like you are not taking responsibility for your actions, can you just briefly explain what it was you was doing and the reason why they came that day to come get you?
Well, I was selling marijuana. I was importing marijuana from different places on the West Coast and distributing it here, not necessarily in real large amounts, but let them tell it. It was a very large.
No.
And so, yeah, can you hear me? Sorry
yeah.
about that. Yeah, let them tell it. It was very large, and so that's what I was doing. But it wasn't on a, I wasn't by any means rich or anything like that. It's not like you see on TV where there was just loads and loads of cash. I did better at some times than other times, and like I said, for what I was doing in my mind, especially given that it was, you know, marijuana, I just couldn't have imagined the magnitude of how they prosecuted the case and used a lot of resources to do what they did. So, but that's
now,
it in
class,
a nutshell.
What class drug is marijuana?
In Tennessee, it's what they call a Schedule 6, and so they have drugs ranging from Schedule 1 to Schedule 6, Schedule 1 being the most dangerous and harmful, you know, such as heroin and different types of opiates, on down to Schedule 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 being the least harmful. I guess the only step beyond 6 would be legal, like alcohol or something like that. So in Tennessee, marijuana is a Schedule 6.
Gotcha. So that's like an aspirin or something. What is Schedule 6? I mean, what else would be considered a Schedule 6 drug?
Say that again?
What else would be considered a Schedule 6 drug? I mean, is that almost like over-the-counter drugs?
Weed's in kind of an interesting class. There's really nothing quite like it. I think, you know, there's other forms of herbs and whatnot that are also Schedule 6 because they are, you know, like hash and different stuff like that. But I'm not sure what else classifies that low. Interestingly enough, you know, on the federal level, they have, it's kind of the opposite. Marijuana is at the very top. Like, it's actually classified worse than heroin and cocaine. And so it's very, very twisted, man, but ultimately in Tennessee, yeah, it's what they call a Schedule 6 drug in terms of punishment for it. It carries the least amount of, supposed to carry the least amount of time or sentence for any controlled substance that you can use or be caught with or distribute. So it's fairly, you know, most possession charges of marijuana up to pretty substantial amounts are usually considered misdemeanors.
So it's it's something that you've been told, and which I believe too, that no officers and no law enforcement really care that much about, and you know, you didn't think there would be that much punishment for the crime if you had gotten captured, but you saw them moving furniture out of your living room. Now, is that illegal?
Well, you know, again, like I said, I had a lot of learning to do. Of course, as all this happens, I began to do a lot of the due diligence that I guess I could have done had I dug deeper before I made the decision to hustle and sell that particular substance. But ultimately, yes and no. What they use to do that is they use seizure laws that are on the books for cartels and large drug organizations. And so these seizure laws do give them the power to seize assets, cash, anything that's of value upon arrest, before even a conviction or any sentencing or anybody's found guilty. It allows that stuff to be seized so that they can't use those resources to fight their case or to buy influence or whatever the case may be. So in situations like mine, they're actually misapplying the true meaning of a law, the spirit of the law, and just applying it to something that allows them to do it, you know, under, I guess, the technical words of the law. And so that's the guise in which they do it. So, yes, in a sense, I guess it's legal. But like a lot of things I found out, legal is pretty much what they decide to do and what you can have the money to establish that it's wrong for them to do it. Pretty much anything beyond that they can do, and they do.
And, Trey, I've always erred to side on the, you know, more side with law enforcement and with the system. And, you know, I knew that when you're dealing with people, you're going to have corruption probably in anything. You know, there's pastors and preachers are corrupt. And if you're just dealing with people, you're going to have corruption. But I thought that, you know, for the most part, things was done pretty correctly. Now, when my mind started to say, what is, because the same thing happened to my father's house. They started taking everything out of there, and they seized all this stuff. And about 2 weeks later, there's a picture of me, my brother, and my cousin on the Metro Police website or whatever for sale. A picture of us that was hanging on my wall for sale. And so I started to realize something is wrong with the system. If they could come in your house, take all your stuff, and then sell it before there's been any convictions. I don't even know at the time he's been in court yet. You know. So,
well, yeah, it's rough, man. You know, there's a term for it, and they call it policing for profit. The units that investigate drug offenses and bring them to prosecution are funded largely by their seizures. So they have an immense incentive to seize a lot of stuff. And the stuff doesn't necessarily have to be correlated with illegal gain. You know, like a lot of my stuff was purchased with money that I definitely didn't get selling weed, but nevertheless, they don't have to differentiate between any of that when they do the seizures. And so it's up to you to go to court and fight that fight if you want to. And again, that takes money, which they do their best to make sure you don't have. And so
man, Trey, something don't seem right about that. Let's dig all in there. But let me continue to talk about you sitting there on the couch and then moving all your stuff out. When you see them, they're backing up trucks to your apartment, they're taking the expedition, are sweat beads starting to form on your forehead?
Well, you know, it was alarming, but at the time it wasn't really my major concern, because right after that, you know, of course, my thought was for my wife and my daughter, and they had already allowed my wife to call my mother and have her come get our daughter. But it was shortly after that they made me and her aware that they were arresting her too, and she was going to come to jail too. And so that quickly took preeminence in my thought process. And you know, just further, you know, it began to get kind of scary and real at that point for me, you know, just for her point of view, because it started to make me aware that they really can do, you know, what they want to do. Because, you know, now it's always been true that I hustle, but my wife never did. And so for them to arrest her, and particularly to give her the bond that they did, her bond was almost $100,000.
Yes.
And like me, she's never been arrested before, never had a single charge levied against her whole life. And so they just, oh, man, it was overwhelming. And so it quickly became pretty heavy at that point, once realizing that I slowly but surely began to more and more realize what I was up against and the magnitude that they were making this out to be.
And so when they arrest both of y'all, did y'all ride the same car downtown? Or?
We did. We rode in the same car downtown, man, and that was a very surreal ride.
Did y'all talk?
Yeah, we did. You know, a little bit. It was mostly me just comforting her and telling her, I just reassured her that I was going to make sure that this did not fall on her in any way. And I told her this is all on me and that she's going to be fine. And that was really ultimately it. It was just a lot of taking it in, mostly. It wasn't a lot to be said at the time. And so it was just very surreal, mostly. But, yeah, we did ride together downtown in the same squad car.
My goodness. I can't even imagine. I think Stephanie would have lost her mind on the way down. They would have had to take her to the nut house. So you get down there, man, and do y'all do all the processing together? Or did y'all,
yeah, well, there was something funny about our paperwork when we got down there. They had a hard time processing us. I remember the guy at the desk said he wasn't going to touch it. I remember him telling the police officer whose job it was just to transport us down there that he wasn't touching it. And so they went through several changes before they actually got us into booking. And then it became bigger to me because as we sat in booking, her and I were there. And then I began to see other people affiliated with me come in to booking.
Oh, my God.
And so I'm seeing, you know, I see one or two guys, and then one or two turns into three or four. And man, booking is it's a long process in terms of sitting, you know, because you just sit in these chairs, basically, after you actually booked and processed, and you sit there for, you know, like maybe half a day. You sit there for a while. You sit there all that day, all that night, and it'll be the next morning if the people who haven't made bond or been released are transported upstairs to the holding facility at the Criminal Justice Center, which is basically a big gym with a bunch of bunk beds in it. And they took my wife, and they were taking all the women who were sitting on kind of another side of the room, the ones who hadn't bond out, taking them to the women's jail. And so I'm having to watch my wife get up and be escorted to I don't know where. And then shortly thereafter, I'm taken upstairs, and you're taken out of your clothes and put in, you know, their clothes and whatnot. And of course, all this is a new experience to me. And so I'm separated physically from my wife for the first time, you know, many, many hours after the situation has happened. It just goes downhill really, really fast from there, man. It begins to get just enormously heavy, man. And thinking back, I know, man, you know, hope is a wonderful thing, even if it doesn't end up the way you're hoping. Hope can just keep you alive, man, because if I'd have known how much longer it was going to be and how much more I was going to have to go through at that point, it would have been too much mentally. I needed to think that there was a swifter outcome, that there was hope. At that point, because I couldn't have known, man, all that was ahead of me and still had the fortitude to make it.
Wow.
It got very heavy very fast.
I remember just talking to you. I don't know if I spoke to you that early, but I remember talking to you, and you was very hopeful. You know, you was like, I'm going to get out of here. You was believing God with everything you had. You was you used everything, man.
I was like, come on, man, this is over with. Are you guys joking? Like, I mean, it is like legal in like a dozen states, because it's like, this is not. I mean, they were going super hard, man. And I was like, you guys gotta be kidding. It was borderline between laughable and offensive to me that you're going through this much. I remember one of the guys, man, that was arresting me. I just happened to notice he had on a Coors Light shirt, you know, like the beer T-shirt.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking in my mind, like, this is ridiculous, man. And I remember one of the police officers having to step outside to smoke a cigarette while, you know, they were waiting. It just in my mind is like, you guys got to be kidding me. How are you stepping outside to smoke a cigarette and then coming back in to resume tearing somebody out the frame by some marijuana? It was just, man, I was like, this is, you know, it was tough, man. But I quickly got past that point because you have to, just in terms of believing that it should be the way you think it should be, because, man, they don't care. It don't matter to them, man. It's amazing how it really doesn't matter, man, to them. And man, I remember shortly thereafter, man, a lawyer came to see me, and he brought in the indictment in its entirety, and it was thick, and it had all the people in it. And he said, man, you're at the top of this pyramid, you and another individual. And he said, man, this is a conspiracy case, and I can tell you now that this is a wiretap case. And that's the first time that it really got solidified that, man, they wiretap. Like, they went through stuff I used to watch, like, on The Wire. Like,
right.
And I used to watch that show thinking, man, them folks are insane for doing something that they will actually wiretap you to get you. If they're going to go that far, then they're going to get you. And, you know, I remember thinking in my mind, that's because, you know, you're dealing cocaine. You're dealing heroin.
Right.
They're gonna get you, you know. And so when he told me that, he said, man, this is a wiretap case. I can tell you that now. I remember thinking in my mind, they wiretapped me over some marijuana. I mean, like I've never sold any amount of cocaine, heroin, anything hard. And so I was very purposeful in what I decided to sell. Number one, because I knew, and there was some truth to it back then, and I guess we'll get into that more, unless your case is kind of put together the way ours was in the perfect storm of just, you know, in my mind, corruption. Then it's very hard to go to prison over marijuana. It's a hard thing. You have to get caught with massive amounts or just something really bad. But so for that reason, and because morally, you know, I wouldn't have been able to deal with my conscience selling cocaine or heroin or something like that.
Right.
So I felt safer, man, and it turned out to be really a false sense of security. And so, man, I remember him telling me, this is a wiretap case, man, and your bond is $500,000. And then he went on to tell me what he would charge. I said, well, what would you charge, man, to take the case? And he told me, man, $30,000. He said, I would have to have between $25,000 and $30,000. I remember thinking, how could this be $30,000 worth of trouble? It was absolutely insane to me.
How would somebody, if they come into your house and take all your stuff and they seize your accounts and they put liens against your house, how would somebody come up with that kind of money, even if they weren't dealing with it?
Well, you know, even as the case went on, it became a reoccurring theme that they thought that, you know, you had some money buried somewhere or some money just stashed somewhere, you know, because I guess it could be done, you know, in a sense, but you, that's the idea.
You,
they make it where you can't. You know, they make it where you can't.
Let me ask you this. As long as you was hustling the people you was dealing with, did you know of anybody that had money buried? Do people really do that?
It's possible, man. I've heard of several I've heard of several cases where people have had situations like that, but they've been more like, you know, the cartel type of deals where it's really, really large amounts of business being taken place. And this just wasn't that, man. It just wasn't that. And so, you know, it can happen. You know, of course, when you make money, you know, you're going to stash it and stuff and whatnot. But in our case, it just wasn't the case, and definitely not at this time. So, no, and like I said, when they wiretap you, not only did they wiretap us, they actually followed and actively investigated and, you know, kind of track your movements. If you did have some stash that, you know, they chances are they'd find it if they followed you for any significant amount of time. And so whatever you do have, wherever it is, if they know about it, they're going to get it. And they have the right to by law. So that's kind of what you're dealing with when you run up against this type of stuff, man. It's I guess we'll get into a little bit more of it later, but the way ours was constructed under conspiracy law, it's just a very broad law that gives them a lot of leeway to do a lot of legal maneuvering, and it's just
tell me, I want to know two things. One, I want to know, I know on the TV shows and the movies, they always say you get one phone call. Tell me if you get that phone call, who'd you call? And also tell me, after they give you some clothes, they take you to a gym, tell me, what was it like that first night being locked up?
Man, it was real sad, man. The hardest part for me was not even necessarily my situation, but my wife not knowing. I didn't even physically really know where she was, you know, and so I knew for what I was facing, I knew she had to be feeling much the similar, because, again, even though I never thought that anything would be of this magnitude, you know, when you hustle, you have to consider the possibility that you may at some point go to jail or go through some things. So I know for her, she had never considered it, and I never considered it for her. You know, I always, to the best of my ability, kept her away from my business where she was not involved in it in any way so that she couldn't be implicated in it. And so I never considered it for her, and so it my concern at that time was largely about her and about my daughter, man. Her just all of a sudden not knowing where we were, man, you know, it was very, that was pretty rough for me, and it was rough for my daughter, because it was all of a sudden, and my daughter had a pretty stable home environment, you know. I picked her up from school every day, me and my wife, either both of us or one of us dropped her off. I put her to bed every night, read to her, tucked her in, you know. We just had a very active and stable home life, and so for her to just have that altered just immediately, and this was her, also this was like a couple of weeks after she started kindergarten. She started her first, you know, first couple of weeks of school, and then this happens. And so, you know, I was really concerned about her, man. It was just really heavy and sad, and especially as it became more and more evident to me that I wasn't going to get out as soon as I thought I was, because I literally thought we weren't even going to get, I didn't even think we would get booked and go anywhere from just central booking. I thought we'd be leaving from there to go home.
Right.
And it just became more and more unreasonable and just bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just was insane, man. And I could go into all that. Maybe we'll get into it later. But yeah, it.
You know we will. And who was the first person you called?
Let's see. Well, I was fortunate enough to where my mom came over to get Akilah, so she was aware of everything, just in terms of something happening. She was there with all the police there, the dogs and all that stuff. So, you know, I was fortunate that, you know, with her being alerted, she ended up doing a lot of the alerting everybody. And so that was very, it wasn't a lot of pressure. I remember in booking, you know, you get calls for free, and we called and touched base with my mom. We called her mom. We called our pastor. I called pastor. I remember calling my dad, I think, or having somebody to call him. You know, we just called basically, you know, our immediate support system to let them know what was going on, to check on Akilah, and you know, it's interesting, again, this is another part of the whole prison industrial complex business side of it. You know, once you go from central booking, you go immediately from an environment where you can call home to where you're pretty much isolated from your family, and the barrier becomes money. And so you go into a gym where there's literally like several hundred guys and six phones. And then in order to get on the phones, it costs money. They're charging you exorbitant amounts of money to talk to your loved ones. And so it becomes a situation where, number one, you got to figure out how this money works, how to get money on the phones, how to communicate to your people what has to happen in order for them to get money on the phones. And you start that whole cycle of having to pay to talk to your loved ones, which gets really expensive, and it becomes really a barrier in terms of the financial part of it, and then just the sheer number of guys that are trying to get on the phone. Literally, you know, they would turn the phones on at a certain time every day, and there would just be a line, man. It would be drama and fights and all kind of stuff, man, trying to get to the phone. And so it
crazy.
Yeah, it became bad, man, fast. It was messed up.
You had to learn, like, this is like a jail life or a jail way of living. You just got to almost learn how to do it, don't you?
Yeah, it's crash course, man. You just get it as you go, man. You got to get in where you fit in. Of course, for me, you know, I end up running to the Lord really fast, but a lot of it's just, you know, you develop some practical wisdom and know how to maneuver in the environment you're in pretty swiftly, you know, because you're going – I mean, if you're like me, I'm going to get to the phone. I'm going to talk to my family. I want to talk to my daughter. And it's, you know, it's one of them things where people, you know, people are going to read you and see, you know, what you're about. And you got to read other people and you know, not be in the wrong spot at the wrong time and all this other kind of stuff, man. Got to be able to see drama coming and know how to deal with the guards and all that type of stuff, man. So, yeah, you get into all that pretty quickly. And, it's, you know, kind of an every man for himself type of deal. And then on top of that, in my situation, there were lots of people, man, that ended up being, especially once we got transferred upstairs to the holding, there ended up being lots of people, man, that were on my case, that were there on my case, some of which I knew and some of which I had never even met before. And so there were people up there that come to find out they're there on my case, and I had never even met them, didn't know who they were. They were associated with somebody else on the case. And so, you know, there's a whole nother interesting dynamic that comes once this happens. It's funny where it's like everybody there, as twisted as the system is, and, you know, we can get into that later, people are messed up too, man, because everybody develops this attitude of innocence all of a sudden. It's like everybody...
Right.
Everybody's like, oh, who, me? I didn't do anything. And, like, you know, they're mad at somebody, you know. And it's, you know, it's like, bro, we're all here for the same reason. You wanted to make some money. You broke the law to do it. And that's, you know, we can debate, you know, how valid that is or whatever the case may be. But that's the bottom line. And so you deal with all of that in cases like mine where there's a lot of going on between people on the cases, lots of frustration and all kind of stuff like that, and who's gonna tell, and you go through all of this kind of stuff, man. And
a lot of that's like a whole different series on its own. And if you will, I'd like to get into just the whole prison life and the stuff you went through and jail. And it was just, man, I mean, it could be a series. It actually has been a series on HBO, but hearing it from your perspective would be very interesting. But let's hop on in. We got about 11 minutes left, and I want to hop on in this, just the system side of it, and I want to get your thoughts. I remember me and you made it. Maybe me and you, I know me and Dad, we used to argue because I don't like marijuana. I hate pot. I used to really hate it. You know, I just don't like what it does. I feel like it hurts the inner city youth or the black youth, and it makes people lazy, and I feel like it's a gateway drug, and, you know, I just don't like it. And I remember we used to have talks about should it be legal or not, and I was against it, you know, just thinking about it, I would be against it. But since you guys went through all of this, and just me learning a lot more, I'm not sure if I would be against it being legal. What is your take on it?
Well, I'll try to make a broad statement and then get more specific to that. Let me first say, like you, I don't use pot. I don't use weed. I don't want my kids to use it. I'm not for the use of it. And so I'm not pro use drugs. I'm not any of that. I do think it's greatly misused, and it can definitely be damaging to a person's psyche. A dependence can be developed with it. But that's like most things. And I think we, like a lot of other things, has suffered a lot of undue demonization. It's been a lot of propaganda behind it. So as regards the legal thing, there's always been this misconception about drugs and how they're viewed and how people use them and why people use them. And they think that for the most part, drug addiction has a lot to do with just the drugs themselves. And that, you know, like heroin, cocaine, or even marijuana, alcohol, whatever the case may be, that it's the drug that messes you up. And they did this a long time ago where they had a study where I was reading and listening to this a while back, where they took a study where they took a rat. If you take a rat and put it in a cage and you take some water and put it in one canister that it can get water from, and you take water laced with heroin and put it in another canister in the same cage with this rat, the rat will almost always prefer the water with the heroin, and then it will in turn kill itself. And so they use that study, like they do a lot, to say that, you know, people get addicted to drugs and they choose drugs and they prefer drugs and it's the drug itself. Well, what they found over the years, that actually it's not necessarily the drug, but it's the cage in which the mouse is in, its environment. And so they've redone that study and took a mouse and put it in a cage that had lots of other things to do. It had other mouses, it had other recreational things, it had a lot of other stuff going on in it. And what they found was that the mouse doesn't go to the heroin anymore. It will go just to the water. And so to bring this over into humans, man, like Portugal, the country, like almost 15 years ago, they had like one of the worst epidemics in drugs in the world. Like 1% of their population was hooked on heroin. And so they did what America's doing now. They try to wage a drug war and pretty much try to alleviate the actual substance from the society, and it got worse and worse and worse, just like it does in America. And so what they finally did was they got a panel of doctors, researchers, addiction coaches, and all these people together and said, tell us what to do, and we're going to do it. And they went and did a bunch of research, and they came back, and they said, just legalize everything all across the board. And there was a big backlash, like there will be with a lot of people that are hearing this, and for a lot of reasons that are perfectly reasonable. But anyway, they went ahead and did it. And so 10 years later, man, drug use in Portugal dropped by 50%. All violent crime associated with the black market of drug dealing completely alleviated. And then since then, and 5 years later, they've actually dropped like another 40%, where now they have one of the lowest drug use rates in the world. And what they do instead of mass incarceration and all that type of stuff, they take users and they use the funds that they would use to police and incarcerate and imprison folks and use it to actually guarantee that people like the mouse have a different cage to operate in once they realize they have a problem with drugs. So they'll take the money and guarantee jobs, and they'll say, hey, listen, if you'll train this person, guarantee them a job, we will pay half their salary. And so we kind of do the opposite in our country. We take people who are on drugs largely because they're marginalized and isolated, and we take them and we further marginalize and isolate them. And it pretty much guarantees that they're going to be on drugs and have recidivism, which is what happens in our modern prison system. So as it regards to legalization of marijuana or anything, like, this is not a new subject. America's done this before with alcohol. They tried prohibition. It didn't work. It caused the rise and affluence of the mafia and all kind of criminal organizations. People did not stop drinking. It got worse. And so they figure that out, and they decriminalize it a few years later. And the same thing's going on with marijuana now. You actually make it more of a taboo when you criminalize it, and you make the distribution and the business of it run by criminals when you do that. And then on top of that, you have to spend a lot of money policing it. You have to spend a lot of money incarcerating and imprisoning folks. And then you marginalize these people and make sure that they can't, or you at least make it a great barrier for them to be productive members of society, you know, because once you go to prison or go to jail or get caught up in the system, it's going to be challenging. Unless you're an intelligent person and you got the Lord, and or you have the Lord on your side and really know how to trust the Lord, you got a lot of stuff to overcome, man. So a lot of guys end up turning back to the streets are hustling, and because of, on top of that, the pressure and depression and all that associated with it, they cope with drugs and this, that, and the other. Because, again, you know, the box or the cage, you know, per se, that they're in is one that has everything to do with how addiction actually works in people. And so as it goes for legalization and criminalizing all that, it's a humongous waste of time for all that we've done on our war on drugs. We've gotten nothing out of it. The bang for our buck is not there. We're spending billions and billions of dollars a year and just absolutely wasting it. And like I said, the problem's never going to be solved that way.
So you would say legalize everything?
If it were up to me, and not because I believe everybody should use everything. I'm not for heroin or anything, but if you want to talk about in terms of actual results, again, with my goal being the same as anybody who would oppose that position, which is to have as few people addicted to drugs, using drugs, selling drugs as possible, it's just proven that, man, the best results are going to go decriminalize it and go to dealing with the circumstances around, the environment around why people are actually using these drugs and getting addicted and staying addicted. And so, yeah, that's, you know, and that's been proven out, you know, over countries that have done it. It works. Doing what we're doing does not work, and it won't never work.
Real quick, can you take about a minute, maybe a minute and a half, and explain what is the war on drugs? What is that, the war on drugs?
The war on drugs, the best way that, and I want to give credit to the lady that, man, she penned this very well. It's called, there's a book called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. And the war on drugs is the government. It was actually developed in the Reagan administration to be just that, a war on drugs, to imprison, to prosecute drug distributors and drug users, and to alleviate the inflow of drugs into the country, and to harshly criminalize those who participate in the sale and resale of any controlled substance. And so there's a war to spend lots and lots of money doing that. And ultimately what happened was is that this was not something that local governments and all that stuff even participated in, because, you know, any police force, if you're a police chief, your number one goal is to go after violent crime, that stuff that is affecting, you know, your citizens, rape, robbery, murder, stuff like that. And so they really didn't even want to participate. But what the federal government did was they basically gave lots of dollars to local police forces, which they pretty much named it, you know, we will pay for you to play. We'll pay for you to play our game. And so they shifted a large part of the focus to drug crimes. And so what happened was, and I would even go a step further if you'd be honest, man, in that book and many others like it, man, she makes the thesis statement that the war on drugs is the new Jim Crow. Jim Crow being the laws that they had back in the South that purposefully and willfully marginalized a whole group of individuals just based on race, which was, you know, black people. There were pretty much laws and institutions which systematically discriminates against you. And that's what our war on drugs does today, is that, man, it just imprisons large numbers of black people, and interestingly enough, white people, Caucasian people, Asian people, any group of people in the United States, but really just contrasting whites from blacks. Whites actually use drugs at a higher rate than blacks do. They sell them. Most people, it's not like what you see on TV. White people get drugs from white people. You know what I'm saying? If there's a white guy, you know, smoking weed, chances are he bought it from somebody who looks a lot like him. And same goes for black people. And so these drugs are being used at the same rate. But if you look at incarceration rates, that's not what's happening. If you go to prison, man, it's a large amount of the black population is in prison. And I'm not saying that everybody shouldn't be. I'm not making any excuse for them. But I'm just saying it's being policed and prosecuted very differently, and it's not just along the lines of who's using it and violating these laws. So
we gotta shut the show down. But the conflict I have in my mind about what you're saying is, even though I feel like it is true, I know it to be true, is that even if they are policing black people in the city, inner city places differently than they would suburban areas, then the conflict in my mind is the black people just, you know, they're still breaking the law. You know, they're still doing the crime. And I don't know, man, we're going to get into that more on the next show if you can. Hopefully you'll be able to do the show tomorrow. Cause
yeah, we definitely need to follow up, man. I'd love to do it, man.
You got a lot of interesting things to say just about being wrapped up in the system. And it really has changed my thinking 100%, man. I mean, you know, like I said, I would usually be wanting to side with the system on certain things just to I'd rather give people of put the responsibility of people of color or black people or the youth. I'd rather put the responsibility on them to change.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree, and I want to make sure I'm not against the police. I'm not against the law. I'm not against law enforcement. I'm for it. I think we need it. I think there's a lot of good in it, but there's a lot of there's a lot in it that's twisted. That's not even serving our country well, and definitely not serving minorities well. And so, pointing those things out doesn't make me. I'm not against it, and definitely not against. Because ultimately, it is up to every individual person, black or white, what you do and how you maneuver in whatever system you're in. And so, just wanted to say that to make it clear. But I definitely would love to follow up with you, man, tomorrow whenever you got a chance, so we can finish hashing this out and get to more of the personal side of my whole journey.
Man, thank you so much. And let's just reassure everyone that the biggest decision you can make to not be in everlasting fire or everlasting bondage and chains is by giving your heart to Jesus Christ and surrendering your will to him. If you call upon the name of the Lord, you shall be saved. And start a relationship with Jesus, he'll come into your heart and save you, give you eternal life and change you. But you can live a life serving him and put you on the straight narrow path that leads to salvation in heaven instead of going into the enemy's path, which could lead to not only prison but everlasting prison that you'll never be able to get out of. So call on the name of the Lord today and get saved and get changed. Trey, this is the Choose the Joy broadcast. I titled this something, and I don't see it right here. My screen is blank, so I hope this even archives, man. I don't even know. But I'll get a title for it, and hopefully we can have Trey back on tomorrow. And really, Trey, we could talk about this the rest of the week if your schedule permits it, man.
But, well, man, I'll be there for you, man. We'll make it happen, man.
Man, I love you, man. This is the Choose to Joy broadcast brought to you by GloryGiftStore.com. Thanks for tuning in. God bless. We are out.